Support for today's episode of Script Apart comes from We Screenplay. If you've just completed a draft of a script and are wondering what next, well, you need to check out We Screenplay. We Screenplay not only offers amazing free resources, like virtual events where your questions are answered by Hollywood's leading professionals, with incredible 72-hour turnaround, format-specific feedback tailored to your specific goals, and a price that no one else can come close to, We Screenplay coverage is used by thousands of writers in every phase of their careers. From emerging writers still finding their voice, all the way to Oscar winners. So if your script is all ready to go, check out one of We Screenplay's labs, where dozens of writers have been repped, optioned, and staffed as a direct result of the real-life industry meetings and hands-on workshops offered by We Screenplay. Don't stay stuck. We Screenplay want to help. Check out We Screenplay by visiting wescreenplay.com or clicking the link in today's show notes. Support for this episode also comes from our friends at Screencraft. Breaking into Hollywood as an aspiring writer can be a confusing, convoluted thing. Fortunately, Screencraft is here to help writers with both the craft of writing and the business of Hollywood. Screencraft has everything for your writing journey, from video lectures starring your favorite writers to hands-on career coaching with their excellent writer development team. These guys offer the best screenwriting competitions designed to help your talent shine, featuring judges that really know their genre, from top literary reps to Oscar-winning screenwriters. Hundreds of past winners and finalists have started their careers with the direct support of Screencraft. Winners have been staffed on shows at Netflix, Amazon, Apple TV+, the list goes on. They've also sold scripts and been hired to write films for the likes of Universal, Lionsgate, Blumhouse, and Hulu. So if you're an aspiring writer, what are you waiting for? Don't wait to check out Screencraft today. Visit screencraft.org or click the link in today's show notes. Hey, Script Apart listeners, welcome back to another episode of this podcast about the first draft secrets of great movies and TV shows. My name's Al Horner, and you're remembered for the rules you break. So says Ben Affleck in the 2023 sports marketing drama Air, a movie that very much took its own advice there in regards to rule breaking. Written by my guest today, Alex Convery, on paper, Air should not have been the captivating cinematic slam dunk that it turned out to be. A drama about the creation of the Nike Air Jordan trainer? That sounds like a tale that's going to play out in grey, air-conditioned boardrooms. It sounds like a film that's going to have limited suspense because we all know that Air Jordan became this huge sports brand, right? And more than anything, it sounds like it could be a nakedly capitalistic celebration of a product, Hollywood scraping the barrel in a time of endless IP and emphasis on brand recognition. Instead, I'm just going to go ahead and say it, Air was an absolute triumph. It's not a film about Nike or any particular product. It's a film deep down about our connection with products and the intelligent people that foster those connections, who recognize how, for better or worse, in a capitalist world, products like the Air Jordan trainer can become symbols of the lives we want to lead, the people we aspire to be. Directed by Affleck, the film starred Matt Damon as Sonny Vaccaro and Viola Davis as Dolores Jordan, mother to Michael Jordan, the greatest basketball player of all time. Alex had the idea for the movie after watching the Netflix documentary series The Last Dance, and, well, I'll leave the rest for him to explain. It was an absolute pleasure chatting with Alex about what he thinks Air says about American consumerist attitudes, and about stories that use an unobvious perspective to frame their subject. Jordan through the eyes of a marketing exec here, like Jesus through the eyes of the devil in Scorsese's The Last Temptation of Christ. We also get into how Air fits into a new Hollywood trend of movies based on products. In the last year, we've had Barbie, BlackBerry, Tetris. There was even a drama about the creation of Flaming Hot Cheetos, and Jerry Seinfeld has a Pop-Tarts movie on the way. Alex naturally had great insights on it all. Thanks to him for being a great guest, and thank you to, you guessed it, our Patreon supporters for helping make this episode possible. If you'd like to get involved in that community, head to patreon.com/scriptapart today, where you can get ad-free episodes, early access to episodes, and the chance to ask your questions to upcoming guests. That address one more time is patreon.com/scriptapart. Okay, that's all the admin out of the way. Let's get into it. This is Alex Convery on the First Draft Secrets of Air. You're listening to Script Apart, hosted by me, Al Horner, and produced as ever by Camille Demet. Alex, great to meet you. Thank you so much for coming on Script Apart today. I loved Air, Alex, despite having lots of reasons on paper not to connect with it. So I'm from the UK. Basketball doesn't have the same visibility here as it does in the States. Michael Jordan isn't the same behemoth here culturally as he is in the US. And I think even Nike, you know, it's obviously a brand we have here, but it perhaps isn't the institution that it is in America, where from the outside, it seems like it's like a global export up there with Coca-Cola in terms of being synonymous with America. In a way, for all those reasons and more, that the film shouldn't play for UK audiences and UK viewers like me as captivatingly as it does. And I wanted to begin there, Alex, by asking if that has been one of the most pleasant surprises of the film and the biggest testaments to your writing, seeing it kind of earn the attention and the adoration of audiences internationally who don't have that built-in love and interest in Jordan, in Nike, and in basketball.
It's funny. I think Harry Kane just signed a Skechers deal, and I had a bunch of people send that to me and be like, oh, here's the sequel to Air. It's how Harry Kane signed with Skechers. So I appreciate it. And yeah, obviously, you know, especially where I was at the time, an unproduced screenwriter and just trying to get my work and my name out there, you look for these kind of Trojan horse ideas, basically convincing people to read the work, right? And to take familiar things like Nike and Michael Jordan, but then hopefully tell a different story than what people were expecting, or an unknown story at the very least. It is a little trick. And I think a lot of that just comes from, you know, when I was in film school, I would do development internships, and I worked as an assistant the first couple of years out of school. And like, whether it was from studying the annual blacklist and just seeing the type of stuff that was on there, or just any of the sort of, you know, hot specs that were going around when I was an assistant, a lot of them were these kind of like backdoor biopics or untold story of this known story. And I think some of that has been hard coded into my spec writing in particular, where it felt like maybe this is a way to get a little bit of a leg up, or at least my foot in the door of a door that is typically, you know, shut, locked, deadbolted three different times. it felt like, Trojan horse, I guess, is the metaphor I will continue to use.
You've struck on something interesting there. Like you mentioned how like you were kind of already exploring biopics and taking existing material. You, of course, wrote a Stan Lee biopic of sorts. And it was kind of about how capitalism and art are these uneasy bedfellows. And it seemed like you were using a biopic as a way of telling like a bigger story and speaking to something bigger. When we talk about the fact that Air did, you know, prove to be so much more far reaching than, you know, an audience of basketball fans, an audience of people kind of interested in the Nike story or anything like that, what do you think it was about Air on that kind of thematic level that gave it that reach? Why, what is the human story at the heart of Air that has led to it connecting in the way that it has?
I mean, it all comes down to character, right? And that's like the easiest thing for a writer to say, but I do think it's, you're trying to tap into something, you know, typically a universal human emotion in your protagonist, right? And that's, it's certainly not something I was thinking about or would have been able to talk about at the time. But now looking back on it, especially like the first and second act of the movie, what Sonny, the position Sonny is in and the battles he's having to fight and the arguments he's having to make felt like a lot where I was as a writer, right? Kind of like felt like the odds were stacked against me, trying to get myself out there, trying to operate in this industry that is incredibly difficult and is unforgiving. And you just kind of feel like, man, maybe my moment has passed me by, you know, maybe it's not going to work out for me. And that's okay too. But so it's, you know, when they say like write what you know or find the personal connection in the story, looking back on it now in hindsight is always 20/20, I suppose, but it's easier for me now to see that I was feeling a lot of those same things. So it feels natural now that I would connect to that sort of character and take that character on that sort of journey. I suppose the journey I was hoping to go on myself one day. And then obviously you bring in the Jordan of it all. I was a 90s kid in Chicago. So some of my earliest memories are, you know, sitting on my living room floor with my dad watching, you know, the 96, 97, 98 finals. I never knew. I unfortunately couldn't contextualize it at the time. And Bulls fandom has been nothing but misery since. But those are some of my earliest memories. So that's so that there's like a, you know, kind of like Proustian element of it. And yeah, the Last Dance just came around at the right time for me when I was looking for an idea. And like, you know, the best ideas always find you, you don't find them, right? So it's like, I wasn't sitting examining every frame of The Last Dance being like, I wonder if there's some sort of movie in there. It's just, I was sitting there Sunday night during lockdown eating tacos, and that little clip of, you know, kind of overviewing Nike and the Jordan deal played, I think it's in episode 4 or 5. It was, I just thought, man, that there's something really interesting in there. And, you know, then you're off.
Well, the parallels between you and Sonny don't end there. Like, this is a character who has a kind of willingness to break the rules. And, you know, in a screenwriting sense, there are plenty of rules that you were breaking in your kind of original spec script. The script is also, you know, it was written with you kind of going rogue the way that Sonny does in the movie. He often will do things without his boss's knowledge from time to time, asking for forgiveness rather than permission. And there are certain parallels from between that and a story I've heard of you essentially writing this without your agent's knowledge, because you knew that strategically this was a bad use of your time because you didn't own the rights to the story.
Yeah, I suppose I never even thought of it on that level, but you're right, you know, and I think it comes down to this idea of, in a way, feeling that the script was always going to be impossible in terms of getting it made. I actually think set me up in some advantageous ways, because I was truly thinking of it as a script that was going to be read and not a script that was going to be made. And that can be dangerous sometimes, but it also does give you permission to try some stuff on the page and take some chances and, you know, write maybe perhaps with a little bit more flair than I would if this was, you know, a studio assignment that I knew was going right to a director. But I, you know, I'm a big believer in that, you know, like, screenplays are written documents first and foremost, and they're meant to be read. And you can only take that so far. You know, it's not a piece of prose, but there is prose in it. And my favorite writers do it, right? Whether you go back and read William Goldman or Robert Towne, and, you know, today it's, you know, Tony Gilroy or Greta Gerwig, like, their scripts are readable before before anything else. And I try to channel that as much as I can, especially when I feel like I'm essentially writing a writing sample, which is what I thought Air would always be.
And one of the preconceived notions about Air that it managed to overcome was this sense that the film might feel like a 2-hour Nike advert, that it was going to be kind of an exercise in mythologizing a product and, I suppose, kind of capitalistic as a result. If anything, the film feels kind of very aware of its consumerism, or the consumerism that's kind of wrapped up in it, and it's quite wary of glorifying that. There's acknowledgement within the movie that these shoes are made in Taiwan. There's, you know, the soundtrack is full of songs like Money for Nothing, with lyrics like, we got to install microwave ovens, custom kitchen deliveries. It feels like you and Ben kind of wanted to have a certain commentary about the idea of a product kind of running quietly in the margins of this movie, perhaps. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and again, it just comes back to thinking on a character level, right? Nike is the company that these people work for, but they are just employees, right? Especially Sonny, who you know, has no equity in the company and you know, is essentially kind of a backroom employee who's more interested in basketball than he is anything else at Nike. So it was just trying to get on that level as much as possible. And then, you know, it when you start to get into the actual conversations about like producing the movie and getting it made and what rights do we need, you know, Ben was very, from that first meeting, he was very certain that he did not want to talk to anyone at Nike, and he did not want Nike's cooperation or even permission to make the movie. You know, the only permission, if you want to use that word, that he wanted was Michael Jordan's permission, which I think really is how the movie was made as well. And kind of, you know, the stuff that's within the movie is speaking on that same level, or at least attempting to. So yeah, I mean, it was never meant to be a Nike commercial. Nike had nothing to do with the production, with the script, you know, and as far as I know, no one at Nike even saw the movie until it was done.
And, you know, it's obviously not alone in this regard. Like, we've had an interesting year in terms of movies that are based on products, movies that could have felt like ads, but instead kind of provided us with some of 2023's most fun cinema, most gripping cinema. Like, I adored Blackberry the way that I adored Air. I adored Barbie the way that I adored Air. Do you have a take as the writer of one of these films on why it is that we've experienced this kind of wave of product-based cinema this year? You mentioned the phrase Trojan horse earlier. I wonder if that's applicable.
It's interesting. You know, I go back and forth on it, right? I've been asked that a couple times. Part of me is like, you know, examining one year in any given year in Hollywood, you're going to draw conclusions that, you know, maybe aren't there, you know, like the release calendar is varied and decided years in advance typically. So like, you know, Air easily could have come. I mean, Air could have come out in 22. It could have come out in 23. It could have come out in 24. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, for me, I do think, especially as, you know, a writer who kind of grew up in Hollywood over the last 10 years, I do think some of it is hard-coded in terms of specs that have worked. And, you know, we were talking about The Blacklist earlier. You know, you go back and look at those over the years, there's always a script or 10 like these on that, which isn't a bad thing. You know, it's just the type of stuff that gets read. So I do think there's something to that in terms of that people are trying those scripts probably more than they were in the 80s and 90s. I think part of it too is just like, look, it's hard to get an original movie made now. So like, in a way, this is like, to me, this feels like an original movie, right? Even though it's not, it's a way to tap into the type of characters I like, the type of movie I like, but still kind of set it within the boundaries of, you know, IP, if you want to call it that, but certainly a true story. So I don't know, you know, I a lot of times I think, man, you're just going to drive yourself crazy if you try to look at it and be like, why did this movie get made instead of that one? You know, because a lot of times it's just like, it comes down to rather like mundane things like, you know, who wants to do the movie and who wants to be in it and who's going to finance it. Each project has its own thing. I mean, even Barbie, you know, it went on. This is not a podcast about Barbie, and I do not know Greta Gerwig personally, so I can't ascribe too much to it. But, you know, that's a project that's been, you know, infamously in development for years and years and years and years. And I don't think it's a coincidence that it took, you know, a very original voice to get it to a place where it got to, which it felt like a really original film, which is funny because it's Barbie, you know, it's one of the least original pieces of IP that's around out there. But it's so, it often comes back to that voice, right? I mean, I think even like the biggest properties out there, you know, the best Marvel movies are typically the ones that are very filmmaker and character driven. You know, same goes with the best DC films. It's the same sort of thing. So often it just comes down to like who's making it, who's writing it, and what do they have to say, you know? Although I don't believe in going into a project or a script saying, this is what I want to say with it. I think ultimately, if the work is strong, it's going to find that perspective one way or the other.
All right. Perspective is an interesting word because this is a film that uses an unobvious perspective to kind of frame the subject of the film. And I love movies like that. I love like The Last Temptation of Christ, you know, the story of Jesus told through, you know, the point of view of the devil. I actually really like Baz Luhrmann's Elvis as well for the same reason. What did you think could be unveiled about Jordan as this kind of like mythological figure almost in American sports, but by telling his story this way through the perspective of Sonny and the characters that we're following in this movie.
Yeah, it's a funny thing, right? I feel like Jordan's, whether you want to call it presence or absence in the movie, became, you know, kind of this talking point around the movie. And it's a question I've certainly gotten more than others, which is like, why is Michael Jordan not in the movie? You know, it's a couple of things. One, I was hardly even thinking about it when I was writing. It just is what felt right. You know, my original draft of the script, you see Jordan in the signing meeting, right? And the idea of it does come back a little bit back to perspective, right? And because Sonny is our POV, I always felt that by not having him not actually meet slash talk to Jordan until the climax of the movie and that pitch meeting, always felt like the strongest way to maximize the tension and suspense of the movie, right? Because if you're hiding, because Sonny is our POV, if you're hiding Jordan from him, then you're also hiding Jordan from the audience. And the audience is then feeling that same frustration that Sonny is. That's like, oh, if I could just get to Jordan, then I could convince him, right? And that's kind of that's the effect you want in the movie. And then, you know, it goes back to just kind of like, you know, standard dramatic principles, right? That like, I mean, it's a very odd comparison, but you know, it's the same lesson that Spielberg learned on Jaws, right? That by accident, that the less you see of the shark, the more dangerous the shark becomes, because he's only in our imagination, and our imagination is always going to do things that that your eyes won't, you know. So that was always in the script, and it was always this idea of everyone knows who Michael Jordan is, right? So, I mean, it's funny. I'm thinking about it now. It's like, imagine you have Jordan sitting at that in the backyard with his mother and Sonny, right? It just feels like a completely different. It feels like a completely different scene, and one that to me is probably less interesting, right? We all know who Michael Jordan is. We know what he looks like. We know who he is. You know what is there to gain from him sitting there? You know, I'm thinking of it gain as in selfishly, right? Like as a writer, what complexities is it adding to the drama of the scene? And then obviously, you know, as Ben has said, and I agree with, you know, what better way to show Jordan than to show him playing and show him as he was and show the actual clips. I think, you know, there's a lot of power to that, although that was in the original script, but so was showing his face in that final pitch meeting. And, you know, ultimately that's a decision Ben made, just in terms of perspective. And, you know, I think it works. So, but it's funny, you know, we could talk about it forever now, but when I go back to just sitting on my computer writing it, I didn't really, it just is how it was, you know, like it's one of those very just gut level decisions that you don't really think about. You're just writing it. And now I'm looking back and like trying to analyze it myself, even though I wasn't doing that originally.
Through using that perspective though, and coming at Jordan's story through these characters, there were certain sensitivities that you had to work into the script. Like you were telling the story of America's greatest athlete, like a black athlete, through the perspective of a white man and the other kind of white men in his orbit. I think we'll probably come back and forth to this question as we kind of dive into some scenes, but you know, it's my personal opinion that the movie does like a number of really smart and responsible things to make sure it's not ascribing credit to Sonny for Jordan's success, and to make sure the person with the most power, who wields that power the smartest and most successfully of everyone on the film, it's Dolores, it's Michael Jordan's mum. But yeah, maybe you can give me an overview before we kind of get into the nitty gritty of the movie. Like, right at the outset of the project, how conscious were you of not whitewashing one of Black America's greatest success stories? Was that kind of something on your mind, and how did you navigate that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it kind of came down to that. It was something that sat in my mind the same way what we were talking about earlier did, which was not to glorify, you know, Nike in 1984 and not turn it into Nike making Michael Jordan a success instead of the other way around, right? And that's where this question of equity comes from. And I, you know, it always was this type of thing where, you know, the stories I like the best are, you know, where the character gets what they want, but realizes it's not what they need, right? And that is kind of where Sonny finds himself, right? Where it's like, I mean, that's that phone call at the end, right? He on paper, like screenwriting 101 talk, succeeds in his goal, right? He gets the family to agree to the deal, but it's not what he needs, right? And ultimately, it's that kind of lack of control. It's the control he has to let go of, right? And that's where the movie kind of flips on itself. And it's this idea of, you know, the shoe would just be another shoe unless it was Jordan wearing it, you know, and it's 100% of that value comes from what he did on the court. And that's just such, man, it's such a powerful thing. It still gives me the chills, even just really like talking about it. And that's again, where it came to like, yeah, this is a really worthwhile thing to examine. And yes, because of just the constraints of it, you're doing it from, you know, Nike's point of view, but ultimately, you know, Nike kind of succeeds despite themselves, which to me is a really interesting thing.
So one of the big differences, of course, between the finished film and your first draft of the movie is the title. It was originally titled Air Jordan rather than simply Air. Was that change a result of being conscious of promising too much Michael Jordan to audiences when, of course, in actual fact, it's more his aura that's felt rather than the man himself being in this movie?
Yeah, I mean, you know, look, that's still the title of it in my head in a way, you know. It ultimately comes down to a rather mundane discussion of lawyers and parsing what, you know, we could and couldn't do. I think ultimately what it came down to was, you know, Michael was not we were able to get to and talk to Michael, get his, you know, quote unquote blessing on the movie and I mean, get notes on it really, but you know, he's not a producer on the movie. He's not benefiting financially from it. So I think there was this feeling of, man, using his name in the title to kind of advertise it probably is just a step too far. It's the same reason, you know, we didn't use the Jordan logo or anything like that in the P&A. But yes, that ultimately is a conversation that happened between lawyers and not myself.
Sure. So your original script includes on the first page, you know, going back to our conversation about breaking some rules and kind of inserting some flair into this script, understanding that it would probably be read and it probably wouldn't be made. The first page of your original script included like a photocopy of the principles of the Nike company. So number one, our business has changed. Number two, we're on the offense all the time. Number three, perfect results count, not a perfect process. It's totally the same at Script Apart, by the way. That's completely how we operate too. Then the film itself, it begins with kind of a montage that's not in your original script. The finished movie starts off in this way that really emphasizes the period setting. We have all these great kind of signifiers of 1980s America on screen. And yeah, I'm curious whether that was something you brought to the table or yeah, whether it was something kind of Ben wanted to introduce and what you think it lends the movie in terms of announcing to the audience that this is a story that's going to have something to say about that time period in America, perhaps.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's that classic thing of you make a movie three times, right? And you're talking about version one and two of or step one and two in said process. When it's a spec script and you know it's going to be read first, I'm also a big believer in you don't have a lot of time to set the movie up, right? Like you want your reader to know what this movie is going to be about and who it's going to be about and what the stakes are as quickly as possible. I'm a big believer in character introductions and stake introductions, especially in a spec script, right? Again, if this was something that Ben and Matt came to me, which they wouldn't have, and said, we want you to write a movie about Air Jordan, it probably would start differently. But because I was writing this, you know, theoretically as a writing sample, it's like, okay, how can we know by page 10 exactly what this movie is about? Even better, how can we know at the end of page one what this movie is about? And that's where, I mean, you wouldn't believe how many YouTube videos I scraped through to try and find the right commercial to start the movie, right? But what that commercial is doing is it's announcing, the stakes of the movie in a way, because it's a Converse commercial and it ends saying Converse, the official shoe of the NBA, and Larry Bird and Isaiah and Magic. And it's just like, okay, this tells you everything you need to know. Every good NBA player is wearing Converse. Converse is the official shoe of the NBA. And now we're going to see Nike, you know? So it's right away, you kind of understand where everything's at. Now, that's writing to be read, right? The nice thing about making the movie is the audience is in their seat. So, like, I'm not saying you can wait until 45 minutes in to tell us what the movie is about, but you have more time to set the stage. And that's where, great, we can spend 3 minutes in a 1984 montage and you can really set the tone of what the world was like and kind of tap into to what you're saying, Al, kind of more of the consumerism of that era. I mean, look, the reality of it is as a spec writer, if I had spent 3 pages detailing every shot in that montage, people are probably closing the script, right? And that just comes down to like the difference between writing to be read and actually making the movie. And as a spec writer, like, I'm a big believer and you should write to be read, right? And that's all you have to start. So, and it goes into the, you know, what you're saying about the Nike, that famous memo, right, of their 10 rules. People tell you not to do that, right? Don't put a picture in your screenplay. Like, what is this, a second title page? I just felt really deeply that everything you kind of need to know about Nike at that time is on that page. And it feels like such an artifact looking at it now, knowing what Nike is today. It's almost funny that memo exists, because it is. It's written like it's a startup company. And like there's like a kind of like sweaty desperation in that memo as well, which again, it's like, can you put a picture in your screenplay? Yes. I mean, you can do anything you want in your screenplay. It's a question of what is adding to the read. And I just really strongly believe that putting that photocopied memo on page 2 added something, you know? And look, there are still people who would disagree, but it's all in service of the read at the end of the day.
Hey everyone, this is Al, just jumping in with a quick word about one of our great sponsors this week. I know this is a podcast about first drafts, but guys, we have got to talk about Final Draft, the world's best-selling screenwriting software. Simply put, it's the easiest way of actualizing that exciting idea you have for a new screenplay. Final Draft 13 just dropped, and take it from me, it's by far the most customizable version of the software yet, full of easy-to-use tools so that you can get more done with your writing sessions. With industry-renowned features like the Final Draft Beatboard, Outline Editor, and Navigator function at your fingertips, you're going to find yourself charging towards your storytelling goals more efficiently than ever before. It's the first choice tool of professional screenwriters everywhere for good reason. So what are you waiting for? Kickstart your 2024 writing journey today by visiting finaldraft.com or clicking the link in today's show notes. Okay, let's get back to the conversation. And you mentioned, character introductions there. It's so interesting. There's a tiny change in how we're introduced to Sonny in the finished film versus the original version of the script, which I think makes a huge difference. Like, as you're establishing who Sonny is in the finished movie, we kind of follow him at a basketball game. We get a sense of him scouting for the future players of the sport, trying and failing to lure them over to Nike. And we also get a glimpse of him at a casino, betting big and losing. And it's interesting, you know, in terms of stakes, Air is a story that we all know the ending of. Like, Air Jordan is a massive brand. So on paper, you know, the dramatic tension is not built into this story from the offset. But there's something about seeing Sonny bet the house and lose that kind of plays a trick on us as an audience, I think. Like, where showing that he has this habit of taking gambles that fall flat, I wonder if it tricks us into believing that could happen again here, and maybe it invites us to kind of park our knowledge that obviously this is going to work out for him.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think it does make a big difference. And, you know, again, it gets back into that thing of, you know, when I'm writing the spec, I want to get into the movie as quickly as possible. So, like, again, big believer in character introductions, right? Like, when you're reading a script, like, it's like interior casino, Las Vegas, you know, you're kind of like, the reader's like, what is it? Like, is this, the movie's in Vegas. What is this? And then suddenly, you know, you're in the Nike HQ. So for me, it's like I wanted to start with Sonny in Nike because that's what the script is going to be. And I'm a big believer in like not misleading the reader. Now, again, on screen, you have the benefit of like, it's this montage, it's high flying, you put money for nothing behind it, it works. And you get to explore the character a little more. You know, it's funny. We shot that Vegas sequence, which obviously isn't in the original script. And there was a question of where it would go in the movie. Because there were a couple different parts where you could fit in him going to Vegas, right? It could be after that first meeting. It could be when he goes to LA to see George Raveling. You know, you could have him go to Vegas after that. And it's so obvious now that it should have gone at the beginning that it's almost ridiculous that we were talking about it at any other point in the film. But it is, right? So character introductions, right? Like the best ones are, like any screenplay, are showing, not telling, right? And this is a version of character through action where you know exactly who Sonny is just by that one 30-second sequence. And like, that's just efficient storytelling, you know? It's telling would be, you know, Sonny walking in and saying he lost everything in Vegas, or he's some, you know, Strasser looking at him, you're a gambler, you know, like stuff like that. It's just the difference in writing well and writing in an expository manner. But yeah, for me, it was like, look, character introduction, right? What we're talking about, like, how do you know who this character is right away? Like, this is the difference between writing a movie and making a movie. Is for me, I just felt like, man, that meeting scene has to be the first scene. Like, you have to set up your stakes right away. And it's like, you know, you show the commercial, you show the Nike headquarters and how different it is from today. And then you're into the meeting where they're discussing like, you know, well, we're going to pick three players and split the money up evenly. And then boom, you cut to this guy sitting in the corner. It's like, who is this? And it's Sonny, you know, and that, you know, like we're talking about. So, okay, by page three of this screenplay, I kind of understand the stakes. I understand who our protagonist is, and I understand what sets him apart. And you know, in a way, the journey he's going to go on. Now, in the finished film, that meeting scene, I think, is at like minute 12 or 15, right? So, again, it's just like you have a little more leeway. But, man, by page 15 of my spec script, like, the reader could easily be checked out. It could be, you know, it could be in someone's, you know, the PDF could be moved to the trash bin of their inbox very, very quickly. So I just like, you know, the stakes are very high on the read.
I love the kind of process movie aspect of Air. Like, I think like the moment in the film where that clicks into gear is the scene in which like we become aware, not just of one version of excellence that we're watching, but two. Like we're watching Sonny at home replaying and replaying Michael making this shot at this game. He's just watching it on his VCR, and as we watch Sonny watching this clip again and again, on one hand there's Michael's greatness, we're watching him make this amazing shot, but at the same time we're also watching Sonny notice what's happening in the play, like his eye for detail and his ability to kind of, you know, see the matrix code of that, if you like. We're watching his competence at spotting talent at the same time as we're watching Michael's talent itself. Can you talk to me about like constructing that scene on the page, and then from there, the kind of process movie that follows is he has to not only kind of, he has to sell in that vision that he has for this player, and there's diplomacy, there's kind of vision, there are all these things in the mix. Can you talk me through it?
Yeah, I mean, that was something that was always very appealing to me, right? Because it's when you like break good screenplays down on a certain level, you should very clearly be able to say what the character wants and what stands in the character's way, right? So for this, a very clean way in, right? It's pretty simple. Somebody wants to sign Michael Jordan. Now, the interesting thing to me is how many things stood in his way, right? It's obviously Converse and Adidas did, but it was always even more interesting that his own company kind of acted as something that could stand in his way too, right? And then obviously you have the Jordan family being, as they should be, hesitant about, you know, meeting with this kind of third-rate shoe company. So I just looked at it like, okay, interesting. Now you have the three kind of worlds the movie exists in. Something stands in Sonny's way in all of it. Now, One of the trickier things was a little bit what we were talking about earlier, which is how are you going to get someone to believe that in 1984, not many people believed in Michael Jordan, right? And that he was this kind of like, he was the third pick in the draft and people thought he was going to be a good rookie, but no one ever could have predicted the heights he went to. As people rarely predict, this person is going to be the greatest basketball player of all time, right? That's few and far between. So, in all my research, one of the most frustrating things was I could not locate Sonny clearly talking about what made him believe in Jordan so much, right? Like the phrase that it would keep coming back to is Sonny just saying, there was just something, I just knew. And it's like, man, that's incredible, but it's also very frustrating as a writer because you have to get the audience to believe that he believes without just him waking up one morning and saying, oh, we should sign Michael Jordan. So we got there. That I think in the script is one of the bigger like screenwriting sheets I have is there's a lot of prose in there talking about Sonny recognizes this like once in a lifetime thing. And ultimately what it came down to is Sonny actually attended that game, the championship against Georgetown. And in all my research, I could find him keep saying like it was that shot, it was something about that shot that I believed in. Now as a writer, again, I cheated a little, right? You have him breaking down the tape. It would have been like, well, flashback to 1980 and Sonny's sitting in the stands. It's just like, it's weird. It's like, I didn't want to explain. Like, I was here and now I'm there, but I'm thinking about that time I was there. It just something about that bothered me. I mean, it was fun just to like nerd out on a basketball sense of like, okay, what about this play can we break down so that, there's a sense of discovery in it. And it was really funny because I thought, when I wrote the screenplay, I had no access to, any of the central characters in real life. I just had research to go on, and luckily there's plenty of it out there. But when I finally was able to meet Sonny, the thing I really wanted to take away from that meeting was, okay, there has to be something that Sonny saw in Jordan that he hasn't talked about in any of these countless interviews or podcasts or whatever it may be that I've gone over. And he said that when I asked him, he said the exact same thing. It was something about that shot. I just knew it. So there's that level of man, there's like almost a mysticism to it. It's like, how could you have known? It's just how. And it was fun. Yeah, it was fun to break that down. And again, it was all about getting the audience to buy into to what Sonny is seeing and get them on that journey as well.
Sonny goes rogue, of course, after this, and he heads out to meet the Jordan family completely unannounced, which risks upsetting the Jordans. It risks upsetting his bosses. It's definitely going to annoy Jordan's agent, who's a great character in this. Can you talk to me about Dolores and how that character evolved? Because from what I understand, it was the real Michael Jordan who asked for Viola Davis to play his mother, and as a result, like the role kind of expanded. The dignity and awareness of her son's self-worth, like her refusal to compromise on what she sees as the value of his talent. It's pretty extraordinary in the finished film. Like you can tell when you read the script that it's kind of, that it's evolving that way, that that's the direction of travel. Talk to me about this character and how you began approaching her and where she ended up as a character.
Yeah, there's so much about it that's interesting. I mean, from the very earliest conception, it was always this idea that okay, Dolores will act as, kind of the proxy for the family, and she'll be the one, negotiating in a way with Sonny, or kind of like, she was guarding Michael, I guess is the best way to put it. And you go back to the research and it's there, right? Michael's saying like it's my mom who did the deal. It's my mom who made me go out to Nike. It's my mom who really pushed for the deal. That scene where he goes to Wilmington and sits with them, that was always there. Almost as is, this the him predicting, how Converse and Adidas would sell them and all of that. Felt it was very important to see Wilmington, and see where Michael grew up and see that backyard. There's just something about it to me that was so interesting. And the fact that they had lived on that same land for generations, it's just there's like a mythological element to it that I really want to examine. There's a couple of great articles. There's this writer, Wright Thompson, who has done two really great profiles on Jordan, one of him on his 50th birthday, which is amazing, and then another kind of tracing the Jordan's roots in Carolina. I just was trying to channel whatever was so kind of profound about those articles into that scene. And then yes, she obviously is still in the movie, but when it came down to the equity of the shoe, that was very much a Nike and David Falk scene. And when Ben met with Michael, he had a lot of thoughts and a couple particular notes on what he felt was essential to the movie: George Raveling, Howard White, and Viola Davis playing his mother. Which like th those first two are certainly easier asks and easier to accomplish than getting Viola. But we were really lucky, that she was available and she wanted to do it. And obviously, once she signed on, we felt it was really important to make the role worthy of her too, and everything she could bring to it. So, I wasn't at that conversation with Ben and Michael, but whatever Michael said to Ben in that meeting had been certain the movie could only end one way, and I mean, I'll never forget that conversation I had with him post that meeting. And he's like, yeah, we have the end of the movie too, because we were shifting around the third act a little bit, and what would come where, and who would be on what call, and would the meetings be in person or not, when they finally closed the deal and the equity of it all. And everything just clicked into place. It after that meeting, we were able to, kind of craft that ending. And I mean, Viola improv to me, like the line of the movie, right? She was just a shoe until my son steps into it. Like that's the essence of it. And I mean, I'll never forget standing on set watching her deliver that. It's like, oh my God, that's the movie, like, and she got it, I didn't. But it is, that's it, and it took kind of that process of discovery to get us there. But I'm so glad that that we arrived there by the end. And obviously all credit to Viola and Dolores for giving us that material.
And in terms of other things that weren't in that original script but made their way into the finished film, the kind of invoking of Martin Luther King's famous speech, how did that end up in the movie, and what sort of meaning did you feel like it imparted onto the story?
Well, George Raveling, it was very important to Jordan that he be in the movie. In the original script, it's kind of his name is mentioned a couple of times because he was Michael's coach on the Olympics, and George Raveling was the best man at Sonny's wedding, and they were very close. But again, it was like kind of a matter of just screenwriting. I was like, I don't know how to get George Raveling into this because the Olympics had already happened, and then it would require him going to Los Angeles. And like, again, when I'm just writing the script, I'm like, I don't want to take us out of it. But then, when Michael Jordan tells you George Raveling should be in the movie, I mean, you put him in the movie. So then it became another question of, okay, he's gonna have one scene, and this scene should make its own case for being in the movie. It has to matter. We shouldn't just throw him in there just because Michael Jordan wants him in there. We should be able to, it needs to pull its weight and add to it. And again, it's just the beauty of research, right? Finding that MLK story. It just thought, man, if we have to embody George Raveling in one scene, like that just felt like such a great way to touch on his character, kind of his ethos, yet also add to this idea of breaking the rules and standing up for yourself and pivoting when something in your gut tells you you have to. That all kind of spoke, thematically to the rest of the movie. And obviously Marlon did just such a great job with the scene. I mean, it's funny, that was literally the first thing we shot, that it was one day and it was that scene, and Marlon came in, you know, I don't want to say last minute, but we were pretty down to the wire getting the script ready to go to production. And you know, it's I love that scene. You know, it's a little different than the rest of the movie. You know, they're in this kind of dark bar drinking beer, and it feels very lived in a way that I think good scenes are. But yeah, that all came from Michael. It did.
Now, that's really interesting. I think it's really effective. I've read a few black critics describing how, considering some of the sensitivities we were talking about earlier, it puts Jordan's achievement within a lineage of kind of black excellence, rather than, you know, him being just a great athlete. He's specifically a great black athlete, and that's significant. Sonny and Rob get this great moment late in the film as they're hard at work, kind of pulling this all-nighter, well, an all-weekender, really. They're getting the kind of prototype designed. It's going to the wire. And in this sequence, there's an interesting note of like discomfort over the shoes being made in Taiwan that Rob expresses. And also there's this kind of gentle reminder of like the human stakes. So Rob has a daughter, he doesn't have custody. His relationship with this kid kind of hinges on his access to Nike shoes to a certain degree. And it all comes at this really interesting point in the film. I don't think the presentation to the Jordan family hits the same way with the same tension without this moment preceding it. Talk me through that.
Yeah, Rob was a really interesting character, you know, who, like always, you try to look at the supporting characters and you're like, you know, obviously what's their journey, but you know, if you had to flip the camera and make the movie about them, you know, what are their stakes and what's their story? And you know, back to the very original draft of the script, you know, I always had this inkling of like, okay, it'll be Rob's birthday coming up, and he's kind of questioning the company. It's gone public, you know, like in theory he's financially well off on paper, but it still feels like something is missing, and there's a sort of emptiness to success in a way. And I just thought, man, that is, you know, kind of interesting to look at in a different perspective than Sonny's, because Sonny obviously, you know, doesn't have any stock in Nike and isn't invested you know, financially in the company in the same way, and hasn't been along for the same ride as Rob has. And you know, we knew he was divorced, and you know, kind of going through this quote unquote midlife crisis. And then it was a very similar thing where it's like, how can we distill this down to one scene? You know, because it wasn't quite working when it was spread out over all these different conversations with Sonny, and it was starting to feel a little one note. You know, him keep, it's my birthday, it's my birthday, what should I ask for? You know, it just was like, okay, we get it. That's just kind of poor writing on my part. But and then again, you know, you get Jason Bateman, and he's, you know, he did such a great job in the movie, and he improved a bunch, and that was one of the, I think it was the last week of shooting when they finally did that scene. And it was just this question of how can you capture the essence of the character, but also make the scene, you know, kind of worthy of existing and speaking to like the larger human stakes in the movie. And that's something, you know, Ben just really understood, and you know, all credit where credit's due. You know, that monologue is a lot of Ben and Jason. But it even like speaks to smaller things in the movie, you know, like that shot where Sonny thinks they've lost the deal and walks outside and is just kind of looking around the office and looking at the different employees, and he sees that drawing that the woman's daughter has done on her desk. And it's like, that's when we talk about like the second step of making the movie. That's the type of stuff you find along the way, and you really kind of code into it just to give it a much more human feeling than you know, maybe was there on the script. But a lot of it, yeah, it just comes down to like trying to get to the essence of a character and what's a story they could tell that stands out or makes them different or you know, creates empathy. For yeah, just an employee at Nike, you know, it turns him into having a much richer and deeper interior life than just what we've seen so far.
I should also ask Alex what you remember of writing the fantastic speech towards the end of the film in that presentation sequence about greatness and legacy and what this deal would mean. It's such a fantastic little presentation that Sonny gives. A shoe is just a shoe until someone steps into it. Then it has meaning. The rest of us just want a chance to touch that greatness We need you in those shoes, not so that you have meaning in your life, but so that we have meaning in ours. That's quite Sorkin-esque, and I can imagine that Moneyball might have been a reference point as, you searched for a culmination for everything that this character of Sonny has been on a journey towards. When you cracked this sequence and that speech on the page, was it a pretty euphoric feeling? Like, how did it come to be? Talk me through it, Alex.
What do I remember about it? I remember watching a lot of Mad Men clips and Don Draper pitches. Yeah, I remember watching a lot of Sorkin. That was definitely the hardest scene, right? Because that's the climax of the movie. At least it was in the original draft. It has to live up to that moment, right? It's all kind of leading up to this speech. The speech has to be worthy of that moment. And that was like a daunting thing. And it was certainly the toughest scene to crack. I do remember I was on a run, which is often when I have some of my better ideas, right out here on the beach path between Venice and Santa Monica. And for whatever reason, the speech was working, but it didn't feel like it stood out the way it should. And I remember, and I don't know why or how or why that idea floated into my head, but I remember having the idea of, oh, you could flash into the future and you could build to what Jordan is going to become and ultimately the trials he's going to have to go through. And I remember just stopping my run, pausing my running app and like jotting down in my notes, like, I'm going to look you in the eye and tell you the future. And then continuing my run. But it was that kind of cheat, if you will, that unlocked the speech and, you know, I think got it to the level it needed to be at. And it's funny because now looking at it, it's like, yeah, the way I was hiding Jordan in the original script, it does feel like that's a natural place for the movie to get to. You know, you've been hiding him all this time only just to show him and show what he's going to be. And I did feel that what we've been talking about, this idea of coming into the movie and knowing the ending before the opening credits even roll and knowing who Michael Jordan is and knowing what he was going to become, it granted permission to go to that place and use that sort of cheat of flashing into the future, which obviously there's a bit of like a supernatural element to it even, but I did feel like the terms on which the audience or the reader was entering into the movie or script granted permission to go to that level. And I don't know, to me, it just made it stand out more than just, you know, kind of a rote speech about why you should wear the shoes, you know, and it ultimately got to that place of, you know, the shoe is just an emblem for the person, and the shoe has zero value unless the person in it creates that value. And that's why they're naming the shoe after him. And yeah, it was not an easy one to do, but as always, it kind of came when I least expected it. You know, the idea found me. I didn't really find the idea. It exists somewhere in my notes app in probably July of 2021.
Yeah, I think like the way that it's able to kind of hint towards some of the tragedy that's going to befall Jordan as well, like, makes it incredibly emotional. The film ends with Born in the USA. And, you know, it's a song that is explicitly addressed in the film. Like, Jason Bateman's character explicitly states that, you know, this is a song with a lot of nuance in terms of what it's expressing about America. It's not actually like a fist pumping ode to freedom when you get up close to its lyrics. What did it mean to you, the fact that that's kind of the note on which this story is brought to a close?
I'll never forget watching the director's cut of the movie and hearing that song on the end, because that was not in the original script. And I just thought, man, that is such an interesting choice. And to be honest, I did not know what to think of it the first time I saw it, because that monologue is so specific about that song. But I remember driving home from watching the director's cut and thinking like, yeah, man, in a way, that's such a perfect way note to end on, because it to me, it's talking about just the messy tangle that the USA can be, right? And it's this idea of you can find, wild success and wild riches, but it will, almost always come at a cost, and it's not quite what you think. And that's all in the song, I mean, that you can go on Spotify and listen to the original recording of Born in the USA. It's kind of a protest song. It sounds more like a Bob Dylan song than a Springsteen song. And I think the evolution of that song into what it became is, we were talking about art and commerce earlier. I mean, that's, you could teach a class on the evolution of that song alone and what it says about our country. And I think that's all in the final kind of segment of it as well, like just that juxtaposition of the Mercedes pulling up to that house in Wilmington and Dolores on the porch. And, again, talking about character wants versus needs, the movie ends not with Sonny celebrating, but going for a run, again, it's just like all of that was very, there's a lot to make of it, and I don't think it's a simple ending in a way, which I really like. And, to Ben's credit, like it was his idea to kind of shoot these final moments for each character. It's something he does really well and why he's a good filmmaker. It's like the same thing in Argo and his other films. It really, to me, leaves it feeling like you've completed a journey, and these characters didn't end in the same place in which they started. And it's a happy ending, but not an uncomplicated one either, and I think that's all within that song as well.
Did you ever hear what Michael himself made of the film?
I've not heard from him personally, of what he thought of the film. I've heard generally that, he liked it, and his mother liked it too, which means the world, obviously. But no, I maybe the time will come one day where I can hear it. But no, I've everything has been secondhand or from a person who heard it from a person who heard it from a person. So yeah, it's interesting, like writing about a big subject like that and a person who will never truly know what they meant to me. There's a lot to it, it's complex, and I hope that was channeled into the script and the film as well.
Well, talking of being like a custodian for, someone's story who has excelled in sport and has meant so much to so many people, the original script ended with a really interesting note. It said, "Sonny was fired from Nike in 1991. He went on to work at Adidas, where he helped court another once-in-a-generation talent, Kobe Bryant." Is that a story you'd like to tell, Alex? Kobe's biopic.
It's very interesting. It's a different story, right? I mean, this is a conversation Ben and I had, which was that actually that was in like the director's cut, and the cuts after that was that text. And I think ultimately, and this wasn't necessarily my decision, but I think the studio was hesitant about ending on a more sour note like that. Even though it's what happened, and I am a believer in like you should tell the truth. But it's a fascinating story, and it's a different one, right? I mean, Kobe, it was a different process than Jordan. Kobe was this kind of unknown, mysterious quantity. He was in Italy. He didn't play college ball. And there were a couple teams he really wanted to go to. So the interesting thing about that is not only was Sonny having to convince him of signing with Adidas America, which was, kind of a new brand at the time, even though it was a, famous company as we know, but he had to try to rig the draft almost so that Kobe would end up on the Lakers. And that involved a lot of kind of back channel dealing. So I guess long story short, yeah, of course. I mean, it's a fun story in its own right. I think it's a little more complicated with you know, the tragedy of what happened with Kobe, and it brings a different weight to that story. But you know, it's certainly, I think, one worth telling, and you know, Kobe's right up there with Jordan in terms of you know, athletes that have changed sports over the last 40 to 30 years here. Yeah, I mean, look, you could really tell the history of modern basketball just through the players Sonny has tried to sign, right? Whether it's Michael, as we know, Kobe, and then almost signing LeBron. Those are the three, right? I mean, that's kind of our last 40 years of basketball right there. And the ways in which each of those deals came together, and how and why and where they ultimately ended up, says a lot about where the game was at and how players were viewed as well. So yeah, 100%. I mean, even just Sonny and Rob leaving Nike is a really interesting thing, right? And it gets back a little bit to the Stan Lee script we were talking about, right? When things get too big, too fast, human emotions always seep in, and commerce is kind of the waters and the gear, and things start to get complicated really, really quickly. And that is interesting to me, certainly as a writer.
Absolutely. Well, we're out of time, unfortunately, Alex, but this has been so much fun. Thank you so much for coming on Script Apart, and I'll see you in a couple of years when you do the Harry Kane film, yeah?
Right, exactly. No, it's a pleasure, guys. Thanks so much for having me.
You've been listening to Script Apart. Thank you so much for tuning in. A reminder that if you want to help the show continue to grow, you can join us on Patreon by visiting patreon.com/scriptapart or clicking the link in today's show notes. Thanks again for joining us. We'll see you next time.